to the Tortoise Shack. Today, I'm joined by co-host Rory Hearn. Good morning, Rory. How are you?
I'm great, Martin. And yourself?
Oh, doing great. Viewers can't see Tony's after, or Rory's after getting a very salubrious haircut. It's Anna, and we're, our guest too is after getting a very salubrious haircut. And we're delighted to be joined all the way from Australia by Niall Conroy. Niall is a consultant public health physician in Australia. He's also a senior lecturer. He has many, many arrows to his bow. Isn't that true now?
Yeah, I mean, it's all just big words, isn't it? Ultimately, yeah.
But and the most important thing is fairly recent daddy as well, which is a great thing to have.
Exhausted fairly recent daddy, yeah. And the way I look at it now is that at least I'm the one who gets a break going out to work. And my poor wife sort of has to man the fort all day.
Rory, you're getting Rory in trouble here. Rory. I will let you start, Rory, with Niall. So off you go.
I just wanted to just put the shout out first, Martin, that, you know, these podcasts are producing a massive amount of content. Great stuff, reaching all the social issues of inequality, exclusion, giving voices to so many different issues across the Tortoise Shack platform. And we know as listeners that you really value what we do. We would call on you, ask, you know, please become a supporter of the Tortoise Shack, Reboot Republic, Echo Chamber, and all across the other pods. There's lots of them there. And go over to patreon.com/Tortoise Shack and help us keep this show on the road, which is an absolutely vital now more than ever to have independent media that is not afraid to challenge the status quo. And also is very importantly pointing out what can be done in terms of getting a republic and much broader global world that is more equal and sustainable. So, Niall, it's great to have you back again. Absolutely fantastic. It's been a few months. New Zealand is at a situation now. It's been in the headlines. It's all gone to crap for you, hasn't it? You fecked up with your strategy.
That's what people keep telling me. But I mean, I've been watching the commentary with bemusement. And I've been watching almost as closely as I've been watching what's happening in the rest of Australia. The Australian context is really interesting. I suppose what you've got is you've got a big chunk of the country, you know, your Sydney's and Melbourne's, your big population centre, and they're struggling with COVID. But there's, you know, there's been this narrative, and lots of it in Ireland, oh no, Australia made a total mess of this, New Zealand's made a total mess of this. It's a disaster. Well, I live in a lovely sort of area of 300,000 people, and I haven't had any COVID restrictions, any meaningful COVID restrictions aside from the border closures, of course, in well over a year.
So that's just because you're fighting it yourself there, keeping it out, one man show.
Exactly. It's just the Niall Conroy show here in White Bay. But look, it's Australia's the size of a continent, and you know, the outbreak at the minute is very localized. It's New South Wales, which is having like 1,000 to 1,200 cases a day. That's bad. Victoria, you know, where Melbourne is, I mean, that's having sort of, they're probably going to hit 100 cases a day soon, you know, and look, South Australia is having a little bit. But to be honest with you, the rest of us outside of New South Wales and Victoria are mostly COVID-free. Now, they're big population centres, like I said, but I think actually if you looked with a bit of objectivity, I think at sort of Queensland, which has a population the size of Ireland, which probably illustrates how the zero COVID piece should work and should have worked in a lot more countries. So what didn't make the media a lot was that we had a big outbreak here in Queensland with 150 COVID cases, which I know doesn't sound like a big deal, but you know what exponential growth, 150 cases just can absolutely be catastrophic. And because we had no other COVID, when those 150 cases started as a small family cluster, we literally took the entire public health apparatus of the state and we smashed it. Now, a lot of people wouldn't really be into what we did. There was 150 cases, and we essentially built a ring of steel around those cases, And we quarantined 19,000 people for 2 weeks. And we monitored them and we test them. And that's a lot, and it's too much for some people. And I totally get that some people would be ideologically really opposed to that. Some people would just think it's impractical. It doesn't make any sense. But it is what it is. When you want to keep living.
When you mean you quarantine them, you mean you quarantine them in their homes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We give them, but you know, it's fairly enforced here. There's no, like, we're suggesting you stay at home. It's a legally enforceable sort of quarantine notice that you must stay home for 14 days and you must have a test at the end of that quarantine period. You know, it's a big deal, but you'd be surprised how, I wouldn't use the word popular because nobody loves being in quarantine. You'd be surprised how well it's accepted here, because it's the price of living a normal life. So now we've dealt with that outbreak, and I'm sure there'll be others, and they could come very soon. But right now, we're pretty much back to, you know, a relatively normal life. And that's what zero COVID is. A lot of people have really made the mistake of thinking Australia or New Zealand have made a mess of it because they get an outbreak. We've never, ever, ever said that we won't get outbreaks. The whole point was, we try to aim for no community transmission of COVID. When we inevitably get community transmission, we absolutely hammer it. I mean, we just put all resources that you can imagine into it. And we hammer
it. The argument would be put back to you that's fine with 150 cases. But when you're at what is the case in New South Wales, when you have thousands of cases, as in New Zealand, that zero COVID becomes impractical.
Yeah, I mean, it's always impractical. It's the case of, you know, how much you're willing to push it. New Zealand are finding that once you get to the stage of having high incidence, that it becomes really difficult to control. And that's, I suppose, reflective of the Queensland approach had always been, we're going to slam it down really early. And so Brisbane went into lockdown for 3 days when they had a handful of cases. New South Wales were less inclined to do that because they were, to be fair to them, they're trying to balance some kind of normal life, you know, with living alongside COVID. Queensland took a different approach to basically, once we get any community transmission whatsoever, we're just going to shut it all down for a few days. And that worked beautifully well. Totally take the point that once you're up at 1,200 cases a day, trying to pull that back. And I have to say, it's very hard to know where New South Wales are going to go from here. You know, what their strategy's focused on at the minute is, you know, is really harm reduction. You've got 1,200 cases a day. That's the ones you've diagnosed. You've got two or three times that you haven't diagnosed. So what you're doing in that situation is you think, right, our main priority here is stopping hospital admissions and deaths and ICU admissions. So they're really hammering along with the vaccination. And to be fair, they're doing very well. I mean, our vaccination was a bit slow at the start, but New South Wales are now vaccinating people faster than either the USA or the UK have ever vaccinated any group of people. And they were really probably the top performers or amongst the top performers in vaccination. So yeah, totally take your point. The zero COVID piece is predicated on not tolerating any transmission. So you get 5 or 10 cases, you gotta really aggressively control it. That's what Queensland does.
Can I return to living with COVID for a moment? And, you know, living with COVID is a euphemism for an acceptable number of deaths per week. That's what living with COVID is a euphemism for. The UK has pretty much decided that it can absorb 1,000 deaths a week, and that's their living with COVID number. In Ireland, we haven't had a number put on this yet, but we're moving into a living with COVID phase. Do you think the government should be honest about the number of acceptable deaths that they're going to use going forward?
No, because I think it's difficult. I'm not saying they shouldn't be honest about it, but I'm not sure there is an honest answer to give to that, because they would say, and I think not unreasonably, that they are going to live with COVID but aim to keep deaths as low as possible. And we're sort of in a little bit of uncharted territory with that. where essentially, let's step back, I suppose. You can't get rid of the death and the ICU admissions and all that when you've got COVID around. When you've got, I think they're kicking around about 2,000 cases a day in Ireland. And again, like I always said, they're the ones you know about. There's two or three times that you don't know about. So what you're trying to do there is you're trying to just, you know, control, minimize the damage. And I suppose, you know, having 2,000 cases a day in August will look different to having 2,000 cases a day next January because of vaccination. And, I think what I'm trying to say is I think they are being transparent enough about what's happening. Whether you agree with it or not, I would have liked to have seen Ireland pursue the sort of zero community transmission model. But now that you have essentially opened the borders, I think there's only about 7 countries on the list where you have to go into hotel quarantine now. Once you've opened the borders, you're getting continuous receding of cases. So every time the public health units are snuffing out a chain of transmission, their new chains are coming in again. And that's everything you see in Ireland is what living with COVID is. And, you know, because you can only really eliminate community transmission when you shut your borders. And I'm not saying that's a solution that works for everybody. It worked well for Australia and is working well, but it's not an infinite thing. It has a shelf life before people just are sick of it. But in Ireland, I think what they're essentially, my understanding of what government and NPHET are saying is that you're not going to control community spread. Community transmission is now a part of life in Ireland, but they're going to control the death rate, if you are, the ICU admission rate, the hospital admission rate, and primarily the way you do that's through vaccination. And Ireland has done vaccination very, very well, to be fair. I think you guys are up at 80% adult vaccination levels, and that will make a huge difference. You know, come into the new year, you know, you'll have kids probably over 12 vaccinated as well. That will hopefully take the sting out of the tail. So I just think Ireland's a really interesting place at the moment.
But Niall, do you not think though that is this question of vaccine efficacy waning, you know, with time, and given when we started vaccinating people, and particularly those in their, you know, 60s, 70s, the vulnerable populations, that question of, you know, booster vaccines, that if we don't have those, that then we're going to lead in a case where you have, and I think Martin, you were highlighting yesterday, you know, NPHET's different scenarios, you know, every scenario, under every scenario, we're potentially, because we'll have colleges reopening, we're looking at, you know, mid to late October, you know, a massive spike in cases, no matter what happens, like you're talking.
Yeah, I agree.
5,000, 6,000, 10,000 cases. And as my reading of it now, obviously I'm not an expert, but that was my sense of reading the graphs and what others were saying, that are we potentially brewing a major storm whereby, you know, unless you have boosters, and obviously there's a whole ethical question of giving boosters when you don't have half the world bloody vaccinated, that we're leading ourselves up to a major problem way before January, in November, late October?
I totally agree. I think looking at, you know, without being in the middle of it in Ireland, looking at the case numbers, it's hard to imagine you're not going to have a spike in case numbers in the coming months. The question is how you measure your problem. And I think where I see the two different sides, it's become a really interesting culture war in Ireland, though I think that's probably, Ireland's not unique in that. I think the US and the UK are exactly the same. But, you know, there's one group of people who are pushing for basically really, really, really strong restrictions in Ireland. Another group who are sort of saying, just let it go. A few people in the middle, you know, and I think where they differ is in how you count your problem. Is 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 cases a day going to be a massive problem if not many people die and get hospitalized? You know, some people say, well, no, it doesn't really matter what our case numbers are. What matters is our hospitalization and death rate. Other people argue about long COVID. And the problem is that nobody knows what's going to happen in Ireland over the coming months. you're going to get a spike in cases. I think that's something most of us can agree on. What one group, I suppose your Neffits and people like that, are saying, well, they're confident enough that we're not going to have massive death rates from COVID in the coming months. And another group of people are saying, well, we think we are. And to be honest with you, it's all become so messy. What I've been saying to people throughout this is, things, looking at the science here, it's really unclear, right? And that's just the way it is. Now, what you have is a lot of really confident people with fancy titles on both sides telling the population either that this is going to be fine or that this is Armageddon. And frankly, it's one of the reasons I've stayed away from the media over the last few months, because I think there's an awful lot of noise around there. But we're in a really uncertain time. And, you know, it's just so hard to know what's going to happen in Ireland over the coming months. And I know people don't like when you say that, but one of the key principles of public health medicine has always been the acknowledgement of uncertainty. And I can't tell you right now if Ireland is going to face a major crisis in terms of deaths, you know, and ICU admissions over the winter, or if the vaccination piece will take the sting out of that tail. I hope they will. And I'm erring on that side, but I'm also not 100% confident about that. Then you've got the long COVID piece. Are all these people going to get long COVID? The data on long COVID is an absolute catastrophe. You know, you've got people arguing that, you know, Ireland is going to see tens of thousands of debilitating long COVID cases over this winter. And you've got people saying, oh, no, it's fine. There's almost none of it. And of course, we know the answer lies somewhere in the middle. But I think one of Ireland's problems, and like I said, not unique to Ireland, from watching the commentary, is that it has become very polarized between we need to do absolutely everything, the government are about to kill all our children, or no, we just need to open up and we need to have Bruce Springsteen playing, you know, in a stadium and with no restrictions. And of course, it's all a lot more nuanced than that. But I think some of the nuance has been lost. So what I would say to people is, and look, I'm only one of the voices amongst all the, you know, amongst many, many voices, and I'm certainly not the the final word in it. But what I would say to people is, we're actually not that sure of what's going to go on. We're in uncharted territory. Ireland has a higher rate of vaccination than most places, and it has a high incidence of COVID. You know, I suspect we're going to get high number of cases and deaths will go up a little bit, but then you're back to what's acceptable numbers of deaths, you know? And I just think it's a very murky place to be. And go ahead.
Yeah. Can we look a little broader? There seems to be a perception that Delta is it. That's it. Once we've dealt with Delta, we've dealt with COVID. Yet we know that in places like South Africa, there are other, we won't even call them variants, but there are other, they are variants of concern at the present moment in time. Now, nobody's saying that these are going to overtake Delta, but there are some worrying signs in the transmissibility, which shows that they could do over time. This problem Rory was referring to earlier as, you know, the global south really not getting vaccinated. Are we just harboring another variant in the global south that is going to come and absolutely decimate us then because we're not prepared for it and we have considered that Delta is it?
Yeah, I mean, everyone, it used to be all Alpha, you know, because we had the normal one and then we got Alpha and everyone's like, oh, Alpha. That's the big dog now. And then that was pushed aside by Delta. And there's no reason why we couldn't get another variant. And certainly, you know, I'm talking a lot about uncertainty. We've certainly got, I think, a degree of certainty that if we don't sort out the global south, you know, the people in low-income countries and middle-income countries, if we don't get them vaccinated, then you've just got all this uncontrolled transmission. And in areas of uncontrolled transmission, you get mutations. The other sort of breeding ground for mutations is people who are immunocompromised, whose immune system doesn't work. And there's certainly much, much higher rates of immunocompromise in low-income countries. People who are immunocompromised, the virus finds it easier to mutate within them. Their immune system doesn't kill it. It can hang around a bit longer. It can mutate without being checked. And that's a concern for me. And I think the whole piece around boosters, like I wouldn't be, I mean, look, it's only my opinion, but I certainly wouldn't be boostering people. I'd be just getting those doses to low-income countries. And I've said it before, I worked a lot in Africa and Sierra Leone and Somalia in particular, and it just kills me to talk to my colleagues there who really struggling even to get their frontline healthcare workers vaccinated. But that's me. I've always been very passionate about healthcare in low-income countries. But even if you couldn't care less about it, even if you are so self-centered as, you know, not to care about anything other than how the pandemic affects Ireland, is that it's in all of our interests for there not to be epidemics spitting out variants in low-income countries. So it suits everyone across the political divide should be utterly united in the fact that we have all these people in low-income countries who need vaccines, and boosters are a bit of an unproven entity. I suspect the data will become a bit more conclusive over time to show that they do work, but nonetheless, they're unlikely to work better than getting the whole world vaccinated would be my feeling on that. So yeah, I think that this is a major misstep, not vaccinating people in low-income countries. And I don't understand it. It doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever. But can there be another variant? Look, the conditions are all there for a worse variant than Delta. Our saving grace is that the mutations tend to occur in the spike protein of the virus that does the damage. And sort of, there's only so many times you can mutate that before new mutations make the spike protein fairly useless. The spike protein has to have particular elements of it that are intact so that it can do its job and it can do its damage. So our hope is that any major mutations in the spike protein, rather than making it more lethal for us, would actually make it less effective. But I mean, I wouldn't bet the house on it, you know?
It's a very interesting one, because it's a question that comes up around the variants, which is, you know, how effective vaccines are against the variants. That, you know, if new variants emerge and the vaccine is still effective, well, obviously, clearly, then it's not the same concern. But is there a potential of variants that would be vaccine resistant?
There's definitely the potential. And again, you know, and I hate the fact that I keep saying it, but we are in uncharted territory. Mm. So it's a funny thing. See, you'll get people who will absolutely swear blind that, you know, anything really, really major mutation that the vaccine wouldn't work against, that would have to mutate so much that the virus wouldn't work. It wouldn't be able to survive in humans. And you have other people who say the next variant is 3 Tuesdays away. And of course, like with everything else, it's just nuance, and the answer lies somewhere in the middle. There is a fairly decent chance that we'll see a new variant, but it's by no means certain. Those chances are raised by allowing the virus to spread unchecked in low-income countries, and especially in countries where lots of people are immunocompromised. So, you know, what in that space of uncertainty, what you do is you try and mitigate that risk and you get all these people in low-income countries vaccinated. But I mean, there are still countries with 2-3% of people immunized, which just absolutely, you know, bewilders me. It really does. You know, it's like sitting in your bedroom when there's a fire in the house and thinking, well, it's not in my room yet. Ultimately, that smoke is going to come under the door and cause you problems, you know. I haven't been able to get my head around it.
I know that you know, previous disease outbreaks over centuries, they have been politicized, but never to the degree that this particular pandemic is politicized. And it is really, really everywhere politicized. And as you said, quite polarized. The idea that we just don't know doesn't seem to fit into a political narrative that exists at the moment. Why do you think that is?
It's because people aren't used to outbreaks. So we were always a bit of a niche group who dealt with outbreaks. There was, you know, in terms of outbreak doctors in Ireland, there's 40 or 50 of them, and that's it, you know. And we work in teams with epidemiologists and nurses and surveillance scientists, but it was always a fairly niche thing. And it was always really, it was totally normal to us. So, you know, just thinking about my non-COVID work these days. So I have a prison where I in my patch where I work. So I deal with them a lot in terms of outbreaks. And constantly find myself in the space going, right, well, look, we're going to try this, you know, and we're going to see what happens. And I'm going to revisit this in a few days. And if that doesn't work, I'm going to try this. You know, if you're dealing with a hepatitis B outbreak, you know, or measles or something like that, you know, I spend all of my days kind of going, right, I'm going to tweak this response. I'm going to tweak that response. And that's what you have to do with outbreaks. That's really your core outbreak stuff, is you try something, you know, and look, we don't just go in blindly. We obviously have a lot of experience in what works, but outbreaks are so dependent on human behavior that every outbreak is different. So it's always about going in and try, you know, using your experience and your knowledge to try what works. And what amazes me now is people announcing, as particularly you saw it in Britain, you know, in 6 weeks' time, we are going to do all this. We are going to ease these restrictions. Whether you could have a mega new epsilon variant or something that comes along and changes all that. I never promise anything when I'm managing an outbreak, even a small outbreak in a school or a prison, you know, or a nursing home or something like that. And I don't know how anyone manages to promise things to whole populations at a countrywide level. But that's the demand is there for answers. And I suppose, you know, the demand is there for answers. And I also think, coming back to what I said earlier, one of the things that's pushed me away from the COVID space in Ireland a lot lately is the COVID, is the culture wars. And I think there's so many people on both sides of the divide who swear they have the answer. So my limited reading, and I'm not a population psychologist by any means, is that people are being sold a lot of answers. Every time I turn on the Irish media, there's somebody there who swears, if you do this, this will solve your problems. The government are not doing this. They're making an absolute balls of it. But if you did this, if you listen to me, this is what you need to do. And in almost every time, I turn it off. I go, this is absolutely...
Have you ever managed an outbreak where you've turned around to the people who are involved in the outbreak and said to them, look, what will solve this is personal responsibility?
No. I suspect that's a loaded question. I don't know what you're going to...
We're entering into what we're being told is the personal responsibility phase of the pandemic.
Okay, right.
And I think it's, you know, I can be personally responsible for myself, but I'm not personally responsible for anybody else. And with a highly contagious disease, the group of people is only as responsible as the least responsible person in the group. So I think personal responsibility is a nonsense. I think it's an absolute nonsense.
Yeah, and it assumes that it assumes that everyone has massive amounts of agency over their own day-to-day life. I've managed outbreaks occasionally in very wealthy families, right? In what has been an outbreak of whatever in their household or their small little social group. And actually, they have got that level of, so I say, well, look, you just need to not go to work. You just need to all stay in your own bedrooms that are en suite. And you need to do all that. And if you do that in 5 days' time, this will be over. And they go, great, brilliant. Yeah, 5 days, it's over. But personal responsibility doesn't really allow for the fact that this is a pandemic of poverty. And I know it's hit every section of society. I know there's very wealthy people who've had COVID. But the reality is everywhere that I've looked, certainly in Australia, you know, every city in the world, you see this thing hammering through, you know, poorer populations. And look, everyone knows that the description now, people in insecure employment who have to go to work. There's just a million stories that people tell you of somebody knowing that they're at risk of COVID, developing a runny nose, but it's the end of the month and the rent is due and they get paid. They don't get sick leave. And is it, well, if I can't pay the rent, me and the kids are out on the street, I might pass on COVID to my work colleagues. What a just an awful decision that is for anyone to ever have to make, right? And these stories, anyone who's managing COVID tells you that these stories are everywhere. They get sold in the media sometimes as rule breakers, you know, and it drives me crazy. People end up, you know, on the front page of newspapers as somebody did this irresponsible thing, you know, and okay, some people just don't care, right? Let's be honest. But the majority of rule breakers that I deal with are not rule breakers. They're victims of circumstance. And it is simple as that. If they could just go home and, you know, be out of the way and not pass it on to anyone else, of course, that's what they would do. But life doesn't work like that. So, yeah, I don't buy into personal responsibility. I buy into society's responsibility to our most vulnerable people in a pandemic.
I think you're absolutely right, Niall, there, you know, the pandemic of poverty. And it struck me, and it within this, and, you know, I look in the area of housing and, you know, you mentioned that, you know, the wealthy person who can isolate in their homes, in their big ensuite rooms. And then, of course, you have, you know, situations of overcrowding, and the CSO statistics that I looked at showed very clearly that there was a higher incidence of COVID in houses in the private rental sector where there was overcrowding, you know, and of course, that's obvious, but actually the statistics showed it. And what it brought up to me again was that there's two more questions to ask you, but I'll combine them. One is that whole issue of inequality, that unless we tackle inequality, it's inevitable that when the next pandemic or as COVID continues, as you say, it still continues to affect those at the bottom hardest and also affects us all, because you can't eliminate it when people are forced to go out to work or where they can't self-isolate. But the other limit or the other major crisis is, of course, climate change, is, of course, where the next pandemic is coming from. And in a way, it's like we're, because of our economic and social models, the way we run the world, it's pushing our societal limits, it's pushing our planetary limits. And how, like, when this pandemic is done, how far away are we from another worse one unless we tackle these twin crises?
We're certainly not getting any further away from the next one, you know, and again, who knows when it's coming, but you would imagine it'll come within a lot of people's lifetimes, you know, who are alive now. And you're right. This is probably one of the most common conversations amongst public health unit staff, is what happens at the end of this. So we see all these societal indicators and structural indicators within communities that tell you, you know, if you have a pandemic here, this is a disaster. And the pandemic is front and center of everything now. But almost every day, colleagues talk to me about, Niall, what do you reckon is going to happen at the end of this? Because public health units and outbreak teams, we were always, I suppose, we were the unsexy side of medicine, right? So we would deal on average sort of with a lot of outbreaks in homeless shelters, amongst homeless communities, do you know, that kind of way. Like we would be dealing with sort of a lot of shelters, a lot of prisons. We work a lot in schools as well, but generally speaking, we sort of exist in the vulnerable end of society. And for that reason, that side of medicine is never particularly well funded. It's a bit like, you'll find the same thing from psychiatrists. They'll always tell you psychiatry is never well funded. You know, it's not what, you know, it's not what people are calling for. At the minute, we've been thrust into the limelight in a way we've never been before. But I'm really, really curious to know what's going to happen at the end of this. Will it be, right, lads, the pandemic's over, see you next time, you know, or is it a case that we'll deal with all these structural inequalities? To give an example from Australia, so we have what we would call locally First Nations communities, sort of Aboriginal Torres Strait Islanders. And they live in such awful conditions that my blood runs cold when somebody tells me that somebody from one of our First Nations communities locally has symptoms of COVID and we're waiting for a test result, because I know what that will do in a First Nations community, because the overcrowding, the poor health literacy, the just the general poor literacy, the amount of chronic disease, the amount of substance dependence. How do you quarantine someone for 14 days when they're a drug addict and they're an alcoholic and they have to go and get booze and drugs or whatever? So there's all these parts of society that don't get thought about enough, and they're absolutely just waiting for a pandemic to come in and destroy them. Now, what the fear that people have in particular of outbreaks in First Nations communities in Australia has led to just a massive response. We have unique pandemic plans just for First Nations communities. But what I'd like to see at the end of this is, well, can we sort things out for these people who, you know, so that when the next pandemic comes, they're not living with 10 people in a house with one bathroom, you know, and they don't all have diabetes and heart disease, you know, and they haven't got substance abuse. So you're absolutely right. Dealing with this pandemic is the first step. You know, but to my mind, the second we get on top of this pandemic, that's when we should start dealing with the next pandemic, to make ourselves less vulnerable to the next pandemic. And that's all about climate change, you know, and that's all about inequality in society. Will that happen? I mean, your guess is as good as mine.
Well, listen, Niall, I have to say it's always an absolute joy and privilege to talk to you and listen to you, and I could listen to you all day. I think you're so articulate, you know, around explaining, you know, from that public health perspective, those issues and explaining it. I really appreciate, and I know the listeners as well will really appreciate you taking the time out to talk to us. And I think we will get there. And I suppose the more we talk about it, the more we get people, you know, on these podcasts engaged with it, policy people, you know, people are listening. And there's no doubt, I think, that people are recognizing, particularly with climate change, but hopefully with this pandemic as well, that those inequalities have to be addressed.
Yeah, and I think if I could say, and it's not just because I'm a guest here, that I actually made a decision a few months ago to disengage with media, because I think there's just so many voices out there, and I just don't think it's been helpful. But I agreed to do this because I think this podcast is one of the few sort of spaces within the media that allows a conversation rather than, can we get a soundbite? Can we get someone to say that this part of the response has been dreadful? Or can we get someone to say that this person, you know, is talking nonsense? Yeah. And there's just a few bits of the media that I still accept sort of invitations to talk with, and this podcast is one of them, because I really like the fact that you can have a sensible, rationalized discussion that's not slammed into 6 minutes and trying to cover 12 topics. So thank you for having me here, and you know, thanks for your service to discourse within the community.
Thanks for saying that, Niall. And we just have to remind people that, look, these podcasts don't exist without patrons, and we need your patronage. So it's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Niall, you've given us a huge amount to think about. And I think in particular, where do we go from here? What lessons have we learned? I think that's a huge thing that we all need to have a think about. Thank you once again for coming on, and have a good day.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.